cliffcentral.com.
By the way, Sia is leaving next week for New York, and I'll be away the week after that. So Ben is actually back to look after everybody.
Yes, Ben.
Yeah, so Ben will be here for a whole week, so you can, if you've been seriously hankering after some Ben, and he's just got back from Amsterdam where he was with Hi Rob, they sent me a bunch of videos over the weekend, which are hilarious.
Were they getting lit?
Totally.
Proper lit.
Well, Ben is very composed, so I got to say, he wasn't, Rob was ruined.
Yeah.
Well, no surprise there.
Yeah, Rob does get very ruined. I always thought it was going to be competitive and Rob was going to try. He leads. He doesn't try and compete with you. He grabs everyone by the scruff of the neck and goes head first, takes the full brunt on himself, and then has people to look after him at the end of the night.
Yeah.
Were these exactly more raucous and wild than Hi Rob and Gord?
I don't know. It's hard to tell. You see, we didn't get... We got those videos of Gord and Hi Rob at like 5 in the morning.
Let's see.
Sort of just talking absolute nonsense to each other.
Yeah. MDMA will do that. Allegedly. Hashtag. So, I mean, there's no evidence of that. I just what I heard. It's just... That was the rumor.
All right. Well, you know what, Gord? You do you. I don't have any problem with this stuff.
I prefer to do other people, but I will do me.
I'm so not put off by people who do whatever they want in terms of substances and alcohol. You know, I mean, people have been doing boring and interesting things for such a long time now that actually you do whatever you want, and the rest of us have no say in it.
Yeah, I mean, look, obviously...
Individual sovereignty
all the way. Drugs can be super bad and destructive, and you've got to be very careful with them, and I think... If you have to choose a binary option, in other words, like ever do it or never do it, I'd say never do it. But there can be a lot of fun. And like if you hanging out with your bro, Hi Rob, on Cliff Central, official Cliff Central Joel mission to Amsterdam, and there's a bag of MD, like why the hell not?
Sure.
That said, you got to be careful about it. But I agree with you, like... Well, I can't understand people's fascination with trying to prohibit what other people do to themselves and with themselves and with other people. Like, who bones what and why in the privacy of their own house? How does that affect you in any way?
Doesn't.
Same as, like, if some people want to get lit on some drugs and that they're at a Joel vicinity and they, you know, let them do what they want. For me, the main thing is, like, drugs are self-regulating in the sense that they make you feel so deeply cuck for so long. And like hangovers, it gets way worse as you get older, that it eventually just becomes unmanageable. If you're not on December holiday with, like, 5 days to recover, you actually can't do drugs. You'll be off work for Monday, Tuesday, and some Wednesdays every week forever.
Drugs are bad.
Okay. They're bad.
They are kids.
They really are. Like, the hangover level of them.
Gord is speaking from experience.
I wanted to ask quickly, I don't know if we have time.
Go on.
I wanted to ask this last week, and I've been having a little like resurgence of being into comic books.
Yes.
And I'm watching these things. The two really good channels I'm watching on YouTube are called Variant Comics and Comic Storian. And they take like a whole year, 2, 3, 4, even recently 5 year long saga of a comic book thing. And they summarize it into like an audio drama. So they show you some of the artwork. The guy like summarizes the story and reads some of the dialogue. They're like voice actors. And it's a really good way to get like a year's worth of comics into a half an hour long story. So it's made me giving a shit about DC. Are great at their animated movies and they're quite good at comics and they're just diabolically shit at movies.
Yeah.
But in the comic world, they're actually still rolling pretty hard and their stories are great. So I've been getting well into old comics that I forgot about for a long time. And I wanted to ask, do you have favorite superheroes? And also, what would your one power be if you could have any
We've had this discussion.
I don't recall finding out what your power is.
No, I don't think you were with us when we had it, but...
You can't be like invincibility because that's more of a power.
I don't like, you know, I mean, Superman is all good and well, but I would like to be able to, first of all, immortality's got to be in there, right?
Or amortality, maybe.
We discussed this yesterday. Yeah, amortality, not immortality, because you want to be able to...
Ultimately, you do want to have the option to switch yourself off.
That's got to be in there, but if... I mean, you could be really cheesy and choose something like flying or reading other people's thoughts or... Being able to, omniscience and omnipresence. You'd go invisibility?
Because it's a villain power. Flight is a hero power. This is from the movie Shazam. Okay. Flight's a hero power. Invisibility is a villain power. And I would like that. You think of the shit you could do. Just the shit you could sit in on. The cuck you could watch. Like the things you could influence. The insider trading you could do.
So you're invisible now. Where would you go first?
anywhere I bloody want, and it would be none of your business, Gareth.
No, but tell me, where would you go with this invisibility? What would you do?
I would just stick around and listen to shit, and I'd go steal a bunch of stuff.
Steal?
Yeah, totally. Enrich myself horribly. I'm a villain now.
Okay, you might as well, huh?
Yeah, I'm stealing shit, basically. Okay. And also listening in on private shit and watching people do their stuff and getting
evidence. What people do in private.
Getting evidence of them and blackmail stuff and then insider trading, sit in board meetings of mergers.
Yeah, you're a horrible villain.
Have a fap sometimes where you're not supposed to be the best.
Okay.
I'd be a real creepy villain.
You'd be a terrible villain. Yeah. Invisible gourd in the room. That would be the one? Okay.
This room feels really full, but there's no one in it.
So you wouldn't want to be able to fly. You wouldn't want to be able to...
I never factored immortality in as an option. So now that's making me think, yeah, fuck, that is definitely better than invisibility. But given that that's a kind of a strange peripheral, I don't know if anyone has that as a power. Some superheroes just are immortal. But yeah, it would definitely be either invisibility or like some kind of mind control.
Yeah. Mind control's the ultimate one, right?
Yeah. And I mean, Professor Xavier vibes.
Yeah, if you can...
But with walking.
Yeah, I don't want to be in a wheelchair. But if you can control other people's minds, I mean, that's... It's also a villain power, I think.
Yeah, it's the best.
But it's, it comes with so much bad stuff because, again, if there isn't consent from that person, you're a creep.
No, I wouldn't use it for rapey things. I'm all about consent.
I'm saying even for consent in terms of, like, you can make people, I don't know, cross the street and then they don't know what they were doing.
I would make them do the weirdest shit and I'd feel nothing. They'd be my little puppets and I'd expend them at will.
Oof. See, I think that's horrible.
But before we move on, do you have a favorite comic? Or growing up, did you have a favorite comic or a favorite superhero?
No, I didn't. I was never a comic guy.
Okay.
I mean, I enjoy...
Because I know you're all about Star Wars.
Yeah, I enjoy the Marvel movies. I enjoy Star Wars. I'm not a comic dude, though. You actually used to collect the comics?
Yeah, it was always... My favorite's always been Wolverine, but with the movies and stuff, I won't be like, nah, it's commercialized. I don't dig it. It's just a bit much.
No.
But in the comic days, at Wolverine, and I also love Gambit from the X-Men.
I used to read Asterix compulsively.
Yes, dude, me too, and Tintin.
No, Tintin I never got into. It's weird.
I loved Asterix, and they recently, like relatively recently, they just years later brought out another one.
Yeah, Goscinny and Uderzo.
Well, and one of the kids was involved because the one dude died. Yeah, I think his daughter or son. Yeah, I loved Asterix.
I loved Asterix too. I used to actually draw. I used to copy Asterix drawings.
Also.
And it was just a fun thing I used to do.
Yeah, they're so clever, those stories, and they're still very, very good.
Amazing. And the stereotypes in them are hilarious. I mean, they're probably quite politically incorrect now. I don't know if they're as popular as they used to be because they would have, the French were kind of these kinds of people who were snobs about food and the British were ridiculous and used to drink tea and warm beer.
Yeah.
And the Germans were these angry
people. Everybody's name is like puns in their language.
Yeah. So it was hilarious. The Egyptians used to walk funny and they were called Artifice and Edifice and things like that. So it was really clever and... I don't know. I mean, maybe now it would be a bit dated, but I have all the Asterix books in a collection.
I mean, I watched also when I was on a flight recently, one of the trips I'd done this year, there was an Asterix and Obelix movie, like an animated Asterix and Obelix movie. It was actually very good. That Getafix gets injured and realizes that at some point he's going to need an understudy because things are going to, his time will eventually come and then they're looking for that. And it's really was lots of fun.
Here's an interesting point. This is from... Twani, who says, "Hey guys, please tell us who's that song, the artist of that song. It's called Swing."
Yeah, I was saying off air, it's such a cool little
beat. You liked
it,
huh?
But yeah, French house,
fun and up tempo. So, what's it called?
Okay, see, first of all, what I'm doing lately is I've got Apple TV at home, so I put that on when I'm going around the house doing stuff, and then it just plays a playlist, and I'll change the playlist every now and then. And this one came up. It's called Swing by Sophie Tucker. Sofi Tukker.
Yeah, it was a cool little beat.
Yeah, and that's called the Mahmoud Orhan remix.
Oh,
now you asked, you're going to get what you asked for.
That just rolled off the tongue.
But Tony also says, "Side note, I could listen to Gord talk all day. Is it weird to want to bang someone based on their way of expressing themselves?"
No, it's not weird. What's also not weird is to deeply regret that decision once you meet me in real life.
Oh, God, don't be so self-deprecating. Mm-hmm. Asterix is very popular in Europe, says Sven. You see them all over in the shops.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's the pirate ship people. They've always got this one black dude that's like drawn quite blackface-ishly. And I don't know whether it's like blatantly, hatefully racist or if it's just that was the way of the day. So there are a couple of things that will have obviously aged badly in terms of political correctness. But I don't think, and I haven't read one in long enough that I'm not going to be certain about this, but I don't, off the top of my head, recall anything being like sinister, ethnocentric or racist or like, you know, hateful towards anybody. They were kind of like celebrating the generals, the stereotypes. But I'd have to go back and check, and I'm sure I'd pick up a few things where it's like, ooh. But I remember the Asterix comics being very much in good spirit.
Yeah, it wouldn't...
Not in the spirit of being dicks to certain people.
No, I think it was just like funny.
There were also characters that were obviously gay and they weren't necessarily like treated terribly. They were just like... No, they were great fun and so wonderfully drawn.
Beautifully put together. All right, so there we go. There's a trip down memory lane with me.
Goodness, what a trip.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of... it's a bit nostalgic.
Hi, Rob. Take that, mate.
Yeah. Right.
If you really want a trip, talk about Asterix with me and Gareth.
Asterix, not acid.
No, exactly. Spread Asterix, not acid.
Put that on a t-shirt.
We've got, like I said, John. I keep wanting to call him Johan. John Funerate, he's coming in to talk to us about a new show that he's putting together. He's also working on a musical for Spud. How's that?
That's cool. Going to be so cool.
Yeah, that's very cool. I love Spud.
Look, I don't have statistics or numbers in front of me, but I'd go as far as saying this is one of South Africa's biggest and most successful franchises.
Big time. Absolutely.
To think of it started off as a book and now has been, you know, two different movies.
Do you guys
and it's also
know,
about to be a musical.
Someone told me last week that J.K. Rowling has given away most of her money to charity, apparently. And now... She's
losing her billionaire status.
Yeah, something like that. And I thought, well, on one hand, that's really nice that she's so generous that she wants to give away all this money. On the other hand, if she's giving away so much that she's going to need to write more books.
is this like on that Bill and Linda, is it Linda?
Melinda
Bill
Gates.
And Melinda Gates mission. Warren Buffett's the same. But it's like saying, dude, you've got as much money as 1,000 wealthy people. Give like 900 people's worth, 90% of it away, you still have God money.
Yeah,
like,
you do.
But Warren Buffett's signed up to leave most of his money. I think he's already given a lot of it away, but like, it's weird. It sounds as if someone is earning a salary of, say, hypothetically, just for argument's sake, 10,000 rand a month, and they're giving away 90% of it and having nothing left for themselves. These people are like keeping the first 10 castles and giving the other 100 away.
Yeah, I suppose it doesn't really matter. How many houses can you have?
It's like if you have several billion pounds and you keep only 100 million pounds, you're still giving away 3.2 billion pounds, but you've got 100 million pounds. Plus, you've already paid for all your property and stuff. So I'm not at all saying it isn't a wonderful and magnanimous gesture. And I wish more people who have vastly more than they could ever go through and that their kids could ever go through would do something like this. That said, as we've discussed ad nauseum on the show, people must do what they want with their money and people with less money shouldn't have to tell them how to do it. But it is a really amazing gesture, but it's not the selfless act that it's made out to be. She's not going back to a Datsun.
No, I don't think so. Is a Datsun a sign of poverty?
Well, it's not a Rolls Royce, mate. Have you driven a Datsun? Have you driven a Datsun lately?
No, I haven't. You know, Gord, we've been talking about how we're going to make parody songs.
We have to, bro.
Ages now, and we've never done it.
All we got to do is just make a time and then sing some songs.
Yeah.
And make an album and become fabulously wealthy and then give 900 of our billion, 900 million of our billion pounds to charity. If you give me £1 billion, I will give 90% of it to charity.
Really?
It's a deal.
Okay.
Yeah, watch.
Wait.
If you want 900 million pounds to go to poor people, all you have to do, if you want to change the world, give me £1 billion and I will make loads of poor people less poor.
I actually think that's a sweet deal.
Yeah.
But who's giving you this?
Well, I should actually crowdfund this. Like, if I can raise £1 billion, 900 million pounds will go to the poor people of the world and start a crowdfunding campaign.
I wish you would just do it because you'd probably end up with like, a couple of 100,000 rand.
I need like 30 pence from every living person.
People wouldn't see
through
that.
Or like 50 pence from every person with some money.
Why am I?
Let's get back to things that matter.
No, but why are we doing it in pounds?
Because J.K. Rowling.
Talking about her.
Got you. Mm. All right, I thought you were just arbitrarily choosing a currency.
Well, if I were to arbitrarily choose a currency, I'd probably choose the pound.
It's a good strong one to choose.
Or the dollar. It's got to be one or the other. Or the to be 100% honest, I would like my ransom money in euros. Unmarked euros.
Your ransom money?
Yeah.
Who are you kidnapping?
I'm just saying, like, that's the only way I'm ever going to get a briefcase full of euros. So in this fantasy, I have daringly stolen.
God, why is that even a thought?
That's not the point.
Okay.
Euros are the best. Like, with my fantasy and my little spy story in my head where I'm a hero.
And your superpower of being invisible.
Yes, I'm invisible. I go and embezzle.
You're a creep.
I get photos of the boning that's not meant to happen.
Oh,
all right, listen. I know that this is way in advance, but some people are really organized and they're already thinking about this stuff and puts the rest of us under pressure.
If we're going to talk
about it's Christmas
December,
party related.
Yeah, December plans.
Oh.
Because someone said to me over the weekend, oh, what are you doing in December? And I froze in terror because I don't think I have any plans and I don't think I want to make any.
Yeah, I'm actually excited for just like not going away and just chilling while things close down for that week and a half where nothing happens. Just chill out hard. Maybe Joel, I don't know.
Yeah, but you see, this is the risk you take. Like, if you're not going anywhere, and I would rather go away in the beginning of, you know, next year.
Mm-hmm.
I like to kind of not go when everybody else is gone.
Yeah.
Because then it's
Well, you just constantly go, so...
Yeah, shut up. I do feel spoiled.
I don't begrudge you. Hashtag goals.
I begrudge me because...
Why?
I've never had a year where I've done so much traveling, and I'm very lucky. I mean, I feel very spoiled.
Work hard.
That's why I wasn't that bummed to have this sort of awesome Metallica Slipknot Australia old friends catch up trip kind of fall to pieces, because I was like, shit, I've been overseas twice this year already. Mm-hmm. No one can really feel too hard done by if their third overseas trip of the year falls through.
Yeah.
But it's a priority for me. I mean, I could be making much wiser financial decisions and not going overseas, but I just figure I'm not yet 40, still in my 30s, go while you can. I think travel is one of those things where, obviously, not if it's at the expense of the kids having something to eat. But travel is one of those things where...
That escalated very quickly.
Travel is one of those things where spending a bit of money, maybe getting into a little bit of manageable debt, maybe, you know, saying I could invest this or I could go on this trip.
Yeah.
I think travel's one of those few things where the indulgent option some of the time is actually the wiser option. Because there's no point only traveling when you retire because you can't do as much cool stuff. There's no point having loads of money if you haven't seen the world, in my opinion.
Mm. All right, well... Don't be judgy. Oh,
life advice.
No, I mean, people do what they want. I just think it's one of those situations where I'll do it when I've got loads of spare cash and can afford it. That might never happen. Make a plan, go, figure out how to pay for it while you wait for your trip to approach.
Here's something interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever looked at those population distribution curves regarding EQ?
No, I've got friends and stuff.
Oh, okay. It's just me then. But the average IQ score is meant to be 100, right? They've had to recalibrate it because we're getting smarter. So
I find that impossible to believe.
No, it's true. We're getting a lot cleverer. The average IQ has actually gone up beyond 100 for most of the humans tested. So they've actually had.
So was 100 like the median?
100 is the middle. It's the median. It's
that
the
how
mean.
100 is determined by that's the average. Okay, I got
correct.
You.
So apparently 68% of the world's population falls within the 85 to 115 range, which is, you know, a few points either side of 100.
Yeah, if you average that out, it's 100.
So what percentage of people do you think have an IQ over 115?
Let me be optimistic and say 20%.
14%. Yeah. And how many do you think have an IQ over 130?
Well, isn't it just over 130?
Yeah.
5%.
10%. Only 1.9%. Oh. How many do you think have an IQ over 145?
I think it's just me.
It's just you. Yeah. Good.
I haven't met any others. They might be out there.
No, only 0.1% of people have an IQ over 145.
Wow.
So how's that? That's interesting. So obviously the curve goes exactly the same in the opposite direction. So that means that only 0.1% of people have an IQ below 55. But below 55, you're basically a drooling, you know, you're a mess. You walk around in circles the whole time. You can't really tell whether it's day or night.
Those are people who are below 55 or have only one leg. So if you're okay, below 55 and have only one leg, you'll spin so fast.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, we've discussed this before, and there are actual uses for the words idiot, moron, and imbecile, right?
Mm-hmm. You know, and like definitions, yes.
Yeah, and they all apply to
different
IQ.
Forms of mental challenge.
Well, correct, but they're I mean, it's considered very politically incorrect now to talk about this, but apparently these things, idiot, imbecile, moron, are actual psychological classification systems, and each one was assigned to a fairly specific range of abilities.
Yeah.
So this is interesting to know. So if you're going to call someone in your office an idiot, you need to know what you're really talking about, right? So an idiot, these are so defective that the mental development never exceeds that of a normal child of about 2 years.
Oh, so that's where you like can't even.
You can't, literally can't
that's,
even.
That's a not wiping own bum
no,
situation.
So imbeciles are slightly better than idiots.
Okay.
Imbeciles are those whose development is higher than that of an idiot, but whose intelligence does not exceed that of a normal child of about 7 years.
It still sounds
okay,
harsh.
So now
though.
You might like be able to do basic maths. You know that the triangle block goes in the triangle hole.
Right, but
you
yes.
can say yes. Now you can express what you'd like for dinner. You can have a favorite TV show and a favorite cartoon. But when people start trying to explain to you like Newtonian physics or tax,
too
you're
much.
Just like, I have no capacity to give a listen, shit about
and
this.
And I guess it's also still in the phase where if you were left alone long enough with crayons, you'll end up starting
eating
to
some.
Think like, how would that taste? Yeah,
yes.
Purple's always a delicious color. So idiots are the least functional. Then it goes imbecile. They're like 7 years. So idiot's 2-year-old child. Imbecile's a 7-year-old child.
Right. So a moron is someone
I find it hard to believe that a moron is smarter than an imbecile.
Right?
Moron feel like that should be low on the list.
So a moron is someone whose mental development is above that of an imbecile, but does not exceed that of a normal child above 12 years.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean,
of these three words, moron is the newest and the only one which was coined specifically for the purposes of medical diagnosis. The word comes from the Greek moros, meaning foolish, stupid. It shares this etymology with words like sophomore, a student in the second year at college, or morosoph, which is a learned fool.
So aim to be called a moron than an idiot.
Yeah.
So sophomore means like, sophos, from sophos, wisdom.
Yes, correct.
That's where philosophy comes from, philos and sophos, the love of right. wisdom. So you've got
you're a fool in
sopho,
terms of wisdom,
wisdom mm-hmm. more, mm-hmm. idiot.
Mm-hmm.
You're a sopho. You're a correct. Wisdom. So the students in their second year of varsity are wisdom idiots.
Now, I find the origin of this stuff really interesting,
yeah, me
like
too.
You do too, the etymology. So imbecile began its life in the English 16th century as an adjective and meant weak and feeble. The word comes from Latin imbecilis, which means weak-minded. It wasn't until the 19th century that it began to be used as a noun. That's really interesting because people now say a slow adult. That's what you're meant to call someone who's impaired, right?
So like an imbecile being a slow adult, to me, you expect the imbecile to be less capable than the idiot.
You think so?
So we need a song for this. Idiots are the worst. They are the most slow. And here's the next thing that's important to know. Know the flow of your thick people. An imbecile and a moron are not equal.
Oh.
Learn your morons and imbeciles. There's an order. It's important for real that we must learn. Idiots are the worst. You teach kids with the song. It's got actions. It starts like this and then eventually ends up a bit more like this.
And then the ones who can't catch onto that song are definitely
and that's a filtering system. Like
yes.
The kids that can't learn the idiot song.
Well, it says here the clinical applications of these words is now a thing of the past. And we hope no one reading this would be so callous as to try to resurrect their use.
No.
I think we just did.
No, I mean, it's you see, for those people who are professionals at getting offended and think they found their gold mine this morning,
yes.
We're laughing at the fact that these words ever were used and how insensitive they are and how in retrospect such barbaric naming of things, mm-hmm. cruel and victim-shaming-y, is ridiculous and outrageous and hysterical that people used to be such cocks.
Mm-hmm.
So please don't now blame us for these words. That
except
we are,
me.
Yeah.
I don't think it's insensitive. I want those good old days back when a doctor would give you a note and say, you're an idiot.
Yeah. Please excuse Gordon from school today. He's being a cretin this week.
So what do you call people who are cleverer than average?
Gordon.
So if you're over 109 to 119, so that's a range of 10 in IQ, they say it's a high average.
Okay.
If you have 120 to 129, you're called superior.
Well, you're 20 to 29% smarter than the average person. That's getting pretty good. Once you're a third smarter than a smart person, you're pretty damn smart. And that's just me doing really smart person maths off the top of my head. You know, check what I can do with a calculator and one of those pads of paper with the blocks.
That's right. And if you're over 130, you are considered
very old.
Very superior.
Yes.
No, I don't like that.
That's when
these
you start
terms
being basically
grand.
An X-Man. Mm-hmm. And not like a Caitlyn Jenner X-Man, like a Marvel comics.
Isn't that interesting, though? I mean, like this stuff. And they have, I mean, there are obviously lots of criticisms of the IQ system, but it's really about pattern seeking. And some people have said that it's not the best way to figure out whether someone's actually smart or not, because there are cultural biases and all kinds of
things. I know
things.
Some thick people that know how to maneuver in business and make a lot of money.
Right.
And some really smart people that can't apply it.
Absolutely. And you mentioned two things just now that are not a good indicator of basic native intelligence, and those are tax, which no one understands, even tax lawyers, because it's all made up.
Total bullshit, yeah.
And particle physics, which even particle physics experts struggle to define.
Well, that's for me, the epitome of the Dunning-Kruger effect, is that in order to fully understand the sheer scope of how much you don't know, you need like three PhDs in particle physics. Like, the people that are aware of not, like, if I knew way more than you about particle physics, that would take the form of me knowing way more about you, the true extent of how much I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, that's the discoveries. Ooh, there's another thing we didn't know. Now we can add that to our knowledge of what we don't know. And that's how quantum physics, it's like so mind-blowing, so hard to understand. The Dunning-Kruger effect says that the less a person knows about something, the more confident they're going to be about what they know. About that subject. So, my Uncle Zeke said that the anti-Christians created evolution and that I'm supposed to have one spin a monkey. That's ridiculous. I don't need no science degree to know that that ain't true. I hate scientists. I love Jesus almost as much as I hate gay people. And that's like, that person is 1,000% sure that they know why evolution isn't true. But if someone just spent 15 minutes explaining evolution to them, they'd go, oh shit, I never knew all of that stuff. And now I'm aware of the fact that there's more to this than I thought, and I don't understand it.
And those people are likely to shut up about these things. But they have discovered that there are two indicators of people's potential success at any stage of their life. If you measure their IQ and you check on their ability to be conscientious, right?
Yeah.
Those are the two things that are the single best combination to indicate success. So think about that. It's not 100% accurate in every case, but they're pretty good indicators.
When I was a kid, standard 3-ish, class 5-ish, let's call me 11. I went to the Institute for People with Above Average IQs, but I got kicked out on my second lesson for hitting a kid.
he was
being a dick to me because I couldn't work out how to tell if a glass is half full or half empty without measuring the water. And the thing is, you turn it corner to corner. And if the meniscus reaches one corner and is below the other, it's less than half. And if it overflows, it's more than half. Think about it.
Okay.
You keep the meniscus of the water in the same place and you turn the glass until you match corner to corner.
Right.
If you hit one corner and you're below the other corner, it's less. And if you hit this corner and you're overflowing, it's more. I couldn't work it out. He'd worked it out. Everyone was waiting to give their answer. Teacher was like, there's two more minutes. Everyone quickly hurry up with this problem. And he was being a puss about having figured it out and the fact that I couldn't. So I just slapped him with the back of my left hand and was asked not to come back. So gifted, but full of shit.
All right. John Funderate's writing seems to have the magic touch. He's famously known as the author of the Spud series, but beyond that, he's involved in lots of other projects. Most recently, he's been working on Benny Bushwhacker, Human Nature, a stage show featuring Ben Foss, and it's already an award winner. He's doing incredible things. That's why we wanted to catch up with him today. And we didn't need an excuse, but I mean, this is as good as any. So let's talk about Benny Bushwacker. But first of all, welcome, John. It's nice to see you again.
Thanks, Gareth. It's been great. Yeah, life's been good. I've been away from the limelight a little bit, which means I've been working hard. If you're in the limelight, you're not working as a writer. Exactly. You're talking about your writing. So now
I'm having to do marketing and events.
It's very tawdry stuff. But it's great to be back in Joburg. You know, it's connecting with the scene. You know, sitting in Durbs, it feels like it's a bit of a battle.
So where do you live most of the time?
Mostly in Durbs, but okay. I wrestled this thing when I was younger. Like, you know, I need to go to Joburg. I need to go overseas. I need to be where it's at. And then when Spud settled that, because I realized I could be anywhere.
This is it. I mean, like, in some ways, the most enviable life of all is the life of a writer, especially a writer who doesn't have writer's block and who can just churn out stuff. And it seems you're very prodigious, because you could sit anywhere in the world and you could write great stuff. It could be short stories, long stories. You could come up with a whole new series in your mind. It's pure creativity, and only you need to be there. There's nothing else that's required, right?
So you end up asking yourself these questions, like I heard you talking about your travel, is why am I not in Madrid writing this? Or why am I not here or there? So it's a weird thing, you know, this putting down roots and getting a home, getting a routine, but that's part of the writing process too. You know, to be honest, for me, when I am drifting around, I find it quite hard to just go, right, I'm going, there's too much stimulus. I almost need to cut out stimulus to, you know, hammer it out, you know.
So are you writing constantly? How does it work?
You know what? I'm now in such a busy period, probably one of the busiest periods of my life, because I finished writing Benny Bushwacker, that's now running, but Spud the Musical, I'm writing with two guys in Cape Town, which is amazing. These two young guys phoned me up and said, this is what we want to do, and they've got this vision. And I'm writing my new novel, which is I'm handing to my publishers in a month for the first draft. And
is there massive pressure because you've had such success so far?
You know what? I think there was. This has taken 4 years now to write this novel, and I've written it three times. And I finally feel like I've hit it.
When you say written it three times, do you mean write it, throw the whole thing away and start again? Or do you mean take it, hammer it around
a bit? I'm saying starting again. It's not necessarily throwing everything away, but what happens is if you change four or five big things, it changes everything. So it's almost a different, you find a different mood, a different flow. So I feel like the guy who's come into land, you know, and now I'm coming in for the third and final time, but this time I've got my flaps out, I'm going to hit the ground. But it wasn't funny enough. You know, I just knew.
How do you know that?
Because it doesn't make me laugh when I'm sitting there reading it. And now I know when you read books, most books don't make you laugh out loud a lot. Most books. But I realized with Spud that was the one key, is that people could laugh out loud. And what I've also realized with my comedic writing is that the better the writing gets, the funnier it is. That it's not like theatre where you can actually just get up and nail a few funny jokes, say some funny things or put on a few accents and make people laugh. You can't really do that in writing. It has to, the level has to be at such a high level to get people on that sort of laughing train.
So how does it begin? I'm sorry if this is boring stuff for everybody else, but I'm always curious about the creative process and how it actually works for you. Do you plot out the story first of all? You almost do like a little screenplay in your mind, and you write down, well, these are the characters, these are their arcs, this is where they're going to end up. This is how I'm going to tie these different threads together. And then you populate the stuff in between.
That's generally what I do. I mean, I work also on a day-to-day basis. So whatever I've planned for, say, this morning, if I'm going to sit down and write, and I've made notes yesterday, I then look at those notes and almost remake them. So I've got a very definitive idea when I go to write what I've got to write. But when I start, I do look at the big, almost in a screenplay-like way, but when you're writing a book, a novel, that actually buggers you around, because you start with this quite good format, and what you realize is that you start to develop these nerve endings that start coming out everywhere, and your job is almost to find where that plugs in, and where that plugs in, and where that plugs in. So when I say I'm writing it over again, it's not like I'm starting with a completely new story, new characters, it's just I'm replugging all the wires, and by doing that, I've got to start at the very first page again.
These characters that you created in Spud have all kind of developed a life of their own as well. And it must have been tempting to take one or two of them and extrapolate that into a series. You know, like kind of when they do these spin-off series from a TV show.
Yeah.
Were people making offers for you to do that as well?
There was talk, not so much offers. I feel like for me, it was actually me. I always got tired of Spud. I don't want to say I never got tired of writing the books.
Well, you finished with high school.
But yeah, you finish the high school, you go and you reflect, and then you have this amazing experience of being in the limelight, people connecting with you, but then it went on for literally 7 years. It just didn't stop. You know, it was like this burner that just kept going, and the movies came. So there was a real sense of, I've got a choice here. Either I'm going to be a commercially successful writer who is known for Spud, and then I write, you know, Rambo and Bogo are sharing a digs in Cape Town, and Spuds, yeah. You know. And yes, if you put it on paper, you go, oh, that'll be funny, and all the people who love Spud would love it. But for me, I felt like I need to write something here that's so far out of my comfort zone. I wanted to write something that wasn't through a teenage boy, that wasn't through an innocent eye, if you like, that wasn't set in South Africa, that wasn't obsessed with the South African condition. But by doing that now, you've got to write something. I mean, my new book set in Clapham, London, and it's called Clapham Grand, and it's about a South African failing to live really well in London. And but it's comedy. But I wanted to reflect almost on more of my life, not, you know, I'd reflected on that boarding school element, and it went far beyond it. So
well,
now
you told that story better than anybody else.
Thank
done.
You.
And,
I mean,
and that's why it became such a hit.
Thanks, yeah. Bert. Thank you. I mean,
it's incredible to me that you are able to, you know, go in a totally different direction. I know a lot of authors who do this. They have a really successful run with something that has, and they almost become stereotyped for it.
That's it. That's it.
Archetyped and character, you know.
And you know, bound. You're absolutely right. And it's also this thing of, I can't beat Spud in South Africa.
Nothing
I write ever will take on like that. I mean, I'll have stuff that could do very well in South Africa, but nothing will puncture the zeitgeist like that in South Africa.
Did it work well overseas? Because I'm sure it had some
worked,
success.
It worked well. When I said work well, I published it into about 6 countries, probably sold about 150,000 abroad, but 650,000 here. So, sure. I mean, just to look at the difference. But how hard it is to get published overseas. Even if you've got something that's selling in the hundreds of thousands, these guys don't want to know your story over there, you know. So this time, I've done it. My big aim with this novel, I'm going to say one of my big aims, is to try and reach deeper into an international market. Because that surely is the future of my growth, to reach more people. I feel like I've almost reached just about every and beyond people who read in South Africa.
Listen, you know how rare it is and how impossibly difficult it is to be an author and actually have commercial success of any kind,
I know.
You've not only had the books, which people have this illusion that if you sell 100,000 books, you're suddenly a millionaire and you never have to work again, which is nonsense.
No.
You probably made more money out of the movies and the rights to the movies.
You're a smart man. You own it, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
And the thing with the royalties is you get them, they filter in after the fact, and you get taxed to pieces because you're not drawing for the money that you spent 3 years writing it, right? So that's almost no paid work. But then when you get it all at once, the tax man takes a big whack, and it does. I mean, it's look, I bought a house. I did some clever things with that money, so I didn't sort of. But it's not a situation where I'm this multimillionaire who can just twiddle his thumbs.
You can't decide you're going to just go and live in Madrid. And have a little Spanish woman make you food so you can write with
that's
a view
it.
Of the city
that's
through
it.
A window.
That's unless not, it was a very, very small
I say
place.
You can have that if you really want it
that's
and you
it.
Set your heart on it
that's
and you
it.
Work towards
you
your dream.
You are right.
Don't let Gareth destroy your dream of having a maid in Madrid. You need a bell that you ring. And
I do. A Spanish maid. You know, Gareth, you might have had something here now. But, you know, you're right, man. And even if nothing I write after this moment ever hits in any meaningful way, what went through with Spud is a unique experience, and I'm happy with that. I'm not one of these people who's madly chasing, but I'm chasing the creative.
In some way, the pressure's off because you've done it, right?
That's it.
You've cracked through that impossible level of success that most people never get to attain, and it's also quite cool. And we'll move on from Spud in a second, but you know, people are obsessed with it.
Yeah, I just want to say that I love those books, and when the second one came out, I reread the first one to prepare for it. So I've read Spud twice, and I've read the others once.
Fantastic.
And thank they're just you. Bloody brilliant.
Thanks, mate. Appreciate it.
And look
that.
At these superstars you've created with the movies and everything else. I mean, first of all, I was so goddamn jealous that you got to spend as much time as you did with someone like John Cleese.
Yeah,
as a child,
that must have been epic.
I mean, I got to interview him both times you had the movies, yes. And I got to spend like half an hour with the guy, and it was he's just hilarious, yeah. and brilliant.
He's
and
so brilliant, isn't he? So
Jesus,
clever.
He's fantastic.
I mean, I would like to know what his IQ is. In talking about
must
IQ
be,
earlier,
must be
I,
way up there.
It's way up there.
And spending time around someone like that as long as you did, and then creating these superstars like Troy has just gone on to become this. Jeez. He's like a.
How about
yeah,
that?
He's
eh?
One of the biggest. Like, I mean, like, it's yeah, amazing. But he's got such a lovely niche because he's like this full-on pop star, but he's taking the gay thing to like the nth dimension and making it really. No, I mean, no way making a joke.
No,
it's,
no, I know what
it's,
you mean.
It's like, it's a gap in the kind of pop market that once now that you've seen it filled. Should have been obvious to begin with. So he's like this ultra diva, but
yeah.
He's a guy.
Yeah, I know.
And I'm super stoked to just see somebody, I don't know, living their truth for lack of a less dickheady way. So yeah, I'm stoked for him.
Yeah, he's.
I had no idea after like the kid from Spud. I found out years later he's now like a global super pop star.
I know.
I was like, what?
A lot of people here are quite surprised by that because I think they haven't maybe followed him. I mean, certainly the younger people have, but. Older people maybe haven't. They
and we don't like own him as a South African superstar.
That's
you know what I mean? Like
that's
we do Charlize Theron.
No,
and
we had him in here 3 years ago, I think. And he came in and I think he was here with his mom. And like,
yes, he's always with us. He's got a family contingent. They almost hang as a group here.
And he came in. He was very chilled and very relaxed. He hadn't yet kind of hit that stratosphere on YouTube
that he is in
now. But obviously he'd had some of the success from the movies. A very together young guy.
A lot of the
people you cast in that movie, and you would have had a hand in who was put into what positions.
Yes.
I mean, you've gone and created this enormous runway for them. It's great, isn't that nice to see other people
fabulous.
Succeed?
It's fabulous. I know. And if I see them popping up or everywhere else or in other shows, I get very excited. But I mean, you know, Troy's a very, very interesting character. He's an interesting cat. Like when I first saw him on video with his audition with his mom, and his mom's South African, right?
Yeah.
So. You could hear the South African accent in the background speaking to him, and he had this sort of slight Aussie twang going on. But, you know, he almost from the beginning for me had this special thing that I wasn't surprised that he went big. And it wasn't so much about his talent. It was just this sort of aura, those eyes, his demeanor, his innocence, the way he can sort of... those eyes, there's something about those eyes. If you look at him on film, the camera just loves him. And it was amazing. I watched this kid with a broken Aussie accent, and I just went straight away,
it was him.
This is him. Because also seeing what we were seeing, which is what all the local kids from schools lining up, you're seeing promising kids, but you're not seeing somebody with like star quality. That
I'm just going to apologize for Gord's emphysema, which is obviously... Jesus. I wish he'd just die and get on with it so we can have this interview.
I don't know. What an idiot. Or is that an immoron or imbecile? I don't know. He's out
but
the
John,
room. We can
do you still speak to these guys?
You know what?
I'm a bloody imbecile, don't you forget it.
Sorry, yes. I know we've got very particular about this now. I don't see them that much, but I mean, I think that's more also about life, just being busy and cracking on. And now and again, I'm in touch with some of the guys on social media.
Yeah.
Troy has gone on now to being a big star. You know, like I would feel now like... I would have to almost try and get hold of his mother to try and get hold of him.
He's got Ariana Grande. Is it Grande?
No, it's a tall.
The really hot one that can't see.
He's
doing songs with her.
Ellen loves him too, so he's always on Ellen. And
he's one of the judges of song competition show. I don't know if it's the Voice or Talent Kings or Idols or one. Which one? Sia, you know the stuff. It's pop culture and there's gayness involved. You must know everything.
You know, guys, that his radio, I mean, he signed up with one of the big musical brands in the world.
Universal.
He's up there with the important folk, yeah.
But it was so interesting, guys. We'd shot three, the third one. We had one more Spud movie to go. We'd given him the script when he was here for... But already when he's here for three, suddenly I noticed a different thing. Suddenly it was like an entourage and he had this coolness to him. Like there was an aloofness to him that suddenly wasn't there. In the first one, he was like... He just loved the other boys. They hung out. They were kind of like a real team at Michael House, running around. And, you know, he was still 13, 14. But now he's...
He's
18, 19.
Just a factor of growing up.
But there was this very much, I think, this belief that these guys said, Universal, whoever it was, this is what you've got to be. You're not going to be this dude doing movies in South Africa, playing roles like that.
Mm-hmm.
They had a vision for him, you know? And so I think these big power players in the world, if you fall into their sphere, they can change your life. and even your personality slightly, you know, because I mean,
reconceptualize you.
That's it. And I think don't discount the power of that.
So what's Benny Bushwacker? Let's get that underway.
So you know what the thing is? This might be a little bit strange off this discussion, but last year, I did a birding big year. Now, I don't know if you've heard of a big birding big year, where you try and see as many birds as you can in the country. Well, I would say now I am. Before that, my dad was very much into birding. So as a child, I learned birds through him, but not like I was never a sort of a twitcher, you know. In the bush, we would go to the game reserve and I would look at the birds as well, you know, and we'd tick off birds, make a list. But then these mates in Durban, these guys I met, big birders, they said, okay, Funder, right? We're going big now. This is like the big year movie, you know, like, you know, with Jack Black and the boys. And there were three groups and we are got this huge competition. So literally I started the year just thinking, oh, I'm going to go see some birds and whatever. And after 4 months, I was like 150 birds behind and I thought I was doing very well. And I suddenly said, bugger this. I'm not going to lose these oaks. I've got free time. I've got the money to get around. I've got the car. I'm going to take these oaks on. And then I met Africa's greatest birder by chance in the bush. Like, we were both looking for a bird. His name's David Hoddinott. When I say he's Africa's greatest, he's ticked the most birds in Africa.
Amazing.
2,200. Lovely guy. And he just suddenly said, John, I can help you. I can show you where to find some of these things. So suddenly I started ticking. It was like the movie, you know, where the guy who's been really struggling starts to kind of...
Was this like an honor bar situation where you don't tick them off unless you have actually seen them, or were guys cheating?
People always ask that.
Do you have to take pictures and prove it?
No. Look, if I say I've seen a Narina Trogon in Bryanston...
Right.
People are going to say, have you got a photo of that, John? But, you know, it's... Yes. You know... It is an honesty thing, but so is golf to a degree, and so a lot of things in life, you know.
Where did you see a Narina Trogon?
You know what? St. Lucia, the forests around St. Right. Lucia.
Did you see a palm nut vulture?
Yes, in Tanzania. Now, I saw...
Hard to find those.
Yeah, you know your birds, eh?
There we go.
Yeah, 551 I got in the end. To come second. I didn't come last. It was a battle for creamy middle. That's what we were calling it. So because the first guy was like way ahead. But it was an amazing year. So getting back to Benny Bushwacker. Last year, Benny and I, in about July, we were doing a gig somewhere. And I said, Benny, let's go stay here. It's a nice little reserve, good birds, Zarkhales Drift up north of Pretoria. And we birded for 2 days. And we were sitting there in the bush, kind of one day around the fire having a dop or whatever at the end of the day, and he was talking about what do I do next, and I said, what about wildlife, what about in the environment, what about, I mean, you look like a bloody game ranger, you put a beard on and you put khakis on, he just looks just right, you know. And we started to talk about this idea. We both love the bush, and I'd had this experience of going to all these places, meeting all these weird characters and coming across all these strange events and in strange places when you go birding. Hey, it's not just Kruger. You end up at sewage works, you know, looking at some thing lurking in the reeds, you know, like it doesn't move. But anyway, that's where it started. And it's, you know, we didn't want this to be a preachy thing. We wanted it to be a comedy about the environment. Sure, there's obviously there's a serious side to it. You can't embrace the environment and without looking at some of the issues. Sure. But it's not lectury, and he plays about 14 characters and he's very funny, and
a whole lot of these people that you'd met into a few of these characters and kind of take the best of them. And some of them are hilarious and wacky and stupid. And
I wrote three batches to start. I wrote a batch like that of weird, wonderful, wacky people who piss me off, people who irritate me, people who I found funny. Then I looked at Benny Bushwacker himself, and I wrote a batch of monologues about him, inventing his backstory. Grew up in Craddock, ran away when he was 13 from home and moved into the bush, doesn't have an education, he's only got about, you know, and that. So I built the character with those. And then I wrote what I would say is my human nature ones, because the real line of this is I started to write about the bush, but I realized the bush is about human nature.
Well, listen, the subculture of birders, for example, it's some weird people.
Yeah.
Right?
I'm one of them now, dude.
Sure. Yeah.
But it is. There's twitching. I mean, I drove a round trip of about 1,400 Ks to see one bird.
Sure. What was that?
Citrine wagtail.
I once went to Spain to see one bird.
A citrine wagtail.
A citrine wagtail.
It's not even an interesting looking.
It's the ninth time it's been to South Africa. So it's
but
like,
it's not even an interesting looking bird.
But what do you do if you dedicate that much mission into trying to find a specific bird and then you don't find it?
Yeah, but that's like you've got to deal with the disappointments of life. Look, I've got a friend of mine who reckons bird watching is very much like womanizing. It's the same premise, right? If you really dig down deep, you've got to learn its name, you've got to identify it from other birds in a crowd.
Its call.
You've got to understand its habitat.
How do you womanize? You go out into the club and listen, and you're like, ah.
Thankfully, I don't have to anymore. I'm a fiance. You see, I've got lazy. But anyway, we're starting this kind of thing of, but look, I understand people go, gee, these Oaks and car keys all with, you know, whatever. But it is like anything else. Once you start to get addicted to anything, you want more and more. So
what was this fancy bird that you made such a mission? Because I'm ignorant. I once spotted a purple crested loon.
So there were two
Lurie,
birds that were, the citrine wagtail rocked up this year, and it's the ninth time it's been in Southern Africa. Okay, so only the ninth in recorded history. So people, you arrive there, there must have been over 200 people. You know, they had security guys in parking areas. And the other bird is went out to sea on a pelagic trip on a boat. Gareth's just looking at me.
Gareth was binning
this
bird.
Oh, look,
bird.
There it is,
that
my
is
citrine
a cool
wagtail.
Bird. It's
look
got
at
a
that,
yellow
Gareth.
Head. It looks like somebody...
It shouldn't be in Africa, Gareth. That's why. It's meant
Hang
to go
on.
To Asia and...
Let's just... You were busy saying that you went on a pelagic trip.
Pelagic trip, yes. Yeah. Out to sea off Durban to go and get seabirds now you go 40 k's off to go get albatross and petrels and storm petrels and those kind of things.
What
right?
are those cool things called with the tail feathers that kind of
fork-tailed drongos?
No man, they've got funny bills. They also seabirds.
Yes,
the odd bills.
Not gannets.
No, not gannets. They've spent most of their time flying.
Pelicans,
almost like albatross.
Spoonbills,
petrels,
flamingos,
frigate birds.
Albatross.
Frigate birds are pretty interesting.
Yeah, I missed out on that too. We had a frigate bird that kept coming in. But now I went out to sea. I must tell you about this, right? Now they've got some serious. They've got three big guides on the boat, and birders shout, eh? Oh, yeah, bird over there! Over there! You're like, jeez, and you're holding on, and you're trying to see this thing flying around. Anyway, this big shout goes out, and the guys don't know what it is. It's this weird petrel. And they start saying, Barrow's petrel. Then they shout, another petrel. Anyway, they suddenly go, this could be a Tahiti petrel.
A what?
A Tahiti petrel off Durban, right?
Good God.
Never been spotted
not a
in,
Tahiti
in
petrel.
Africa.
No.
No, now you're going to look there. But it never has been seen in Africa. It's not in Roberts, right? So our boat trip discovered the first ever Tahiti
not
petrel.
Not even in Roberts.
So the new edition of Roberts is going to have a Tahiti petrel.
Bloody hell, you showed them.
Yeah, I showed them.
Screw all those books and movies and that other crap that you've wasted your life on. Why do you go around,
the
problem John van der Rey, author of Spud, you should be, John van der Rey, the petrel oak.
And not giving you petrel, dude. It's
no,
just like spotting petrel.
You spotted the Tahiti petrel, mate. That's going to go on. That's gravestone material
right
there.
So I'm sure there's some birder at home now who's got very excited about this.
That's cool.
No,
of course.
But anyway, and now publishers have sniffed around and said, do you want to write your big year? And I don't know if I want to, but it could be a nice little Bill Bryson-esque kind of adventure.
I think you, because you're good at telling stories, you would color it in with, you know, you'd have the birds.
With fiction, with lies.
Yeah, but no, not with lies, but with, you'd
I know
take
what you mean. Yeah, exactly.
Your experiences
and
distill them into something meaningful. I think that's a rare talent, and it's something very few people are able to do effectively. So yeah, I think you could, but I quite like the idea of this fictional Benny Bushwhacker, rather. Now, a musical's a very different thing to do.
Yes,
right?
Fabulous thing to do.
Yes.
A fabulous.
Out of my comfort zone.
I wanted
now.
To ask you earlier, you said the guys that you're collaborating on, presumably the guys that are dealing with the music, you said they're young. How young is young?
So I would say about, one's about 30, 31, another guy's about 23.
Okay, so they're not teenagers.
I'd never heard of these guys. I mean, look, the musician they are. That's basically a songwriting team. One does the lyrics and one does the music. The guy who did the music studied under Alan Menken, the great Hollywood guy and he's actually been sending him stuff. So I'm not saying he's kind of like on his shoulder, but he's got. Yeah. When I saw that, I thought, okay, this guy, this is where we, you know, this is a good sign.
Yeah.
It's not just like something like, I love your books.
These are credentials.
I've got a piano at home, and, you know. So it's been a great process. My role's been basically trying to build it, and their role, give me the songs, and then together we try and, you know, it's lovely. I think it's going to make it
have
better.
You cast
better musical.
It now?
No. We are. I reckon script will be in by January, February. We'll be script, and I think there'll be still some more time on the music. You don't want to rush that, you know. Like, we're going to, I think, look at all the first drafts songs and say, like, where our strength ones are and where can we, you know, build more. So I still think there's some time to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's, you know, they say there's no bigger graveyard than a musical graveyard because, you know, it's. You're probably looking at, I can't see how you would do it for less than 10 million rand. It's like a film. It's like
a huge production.
So you need buy-in and investment. So that's the second part. Which
took me
we'll
a
get
moment
to
understand what you meant. I'm thinking to myself, like, firstly, where are these musical graveyards? They sound so much more upbeat than the gloomy, silent ones. And why are they so big? Like, anyway.
But it is. A musical is also risky as hell because if it doesn't work, now you've paid for all of the sets and you've paid these actors and you've booked out a theater and it's a disaster. I mean, if it doesn't work, it's.
I know. And we've seen that.
But don't worry about that. Yours will be wonderful.
Thank you. But, you know, Gareth, I mean, we are in a time now where teen musicals around the world are humming. You know, it's become much more a teen orientated thing. And I just writing it at the moment, I think Spud has.
You should ask,
it could be one of those. You know?
Should ask Gord to maybe write some songs. You heard
I'm
how,
all of about it, man.
Come on.
Some parody lyrics.
Oh,
there.
I love it.
Yeah.
Spider, everyone's sick of being bullied.
Haven't got any hair on my nuts. It's not great. I must tell you guys that not a single person wants to bone me. I'm Spud. My hair, my balls are gone. I'm lonely. I'm Spud. Somebody, for the love of God, come have sex with me. My teacher is nice. Not my best work, but I was put on the spot.
Eerily similar to the book. Well done, mate.
I was going to ask you also quickly about John Cleese. They say he's got that, like, you know, funny as hell but depressive vibe going on, that Robin Williams thing. Did you pick that up in him?
Yeah.
Did you pick up a sense of, like, sadness?
He talks openly about being in therapy
for
most of his life.
Stephen Fry, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
All these
very funny, smart guys. Very funny boys. There's a torturedness about them.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the genius. Honestly, I think if you're too happy, you're never going to be the greatest comic, you know? Dave Chappelle, look at these difficult characters who made it in comedy, you know? And it is. He's a very vulnerable character. So he comes across like a very intimidating. I mean, he is intimidating. Like, I mean, I would always get slightly nervous or butterflies when I had to go, you know, have dinner with him or, you know, spend time with him working just before I saw him, because he is that, you know, and he's formal, but he was very loving to me. He's almost got that sort of father son thing going, you know. We had a wonderful moment. He was staying at the Cape Grace. I don't know if I've got time, Gareth, but
no, go ahead.
Staying at the Cape Grace, and he said, join me for lunch on Sunday. We'll find a spot around the waterfront to go and have lunch. So I went down, and I got a lift down to the Cape Grace, and I walked in there, and you're like, go to the hotel. I'm here for Mr. Cleese. And they said, okay, phone up his suite. And he came down, like, oh, yeah, you know. And he said, I bought us some umbrellas because the weather looks a bit iffy. So there we walked. Like, it was Monty Python with two umbrellas, like two black umbrellas, walking down the, you know, at the waterfront. And so he took me, he wanted to buy something for his wife. So he took me shopping, and then he's like, what do you think about this? And you just realize that around you, people are just starting to gather, right?
Yeah.
And you're in the shop, and I'm just aware of all these people. This is real fame, you know? I mean, this is not just being well known. And by the time he's finished buying this thing, he walks out and there's just a crowd of people. And they're like, somebody comes up, Mr. Cleese, can I have a selfie? And he went, no, I don't do selfies. And the guy just, like, looked at him like he couldn't believe it. And he says, can I have an autograph? No, I'm in my spare time. I don't come up and... And he's just starting to get really sort of upset about it.
It's my spare time.
Yeah.
So, and then we went off into a restaurant and there was nobody there. We sat down. He gets the wine list and he goes... Now, who does this? Ah, yes. I'd like to try all of them. Is that possible? Of course, Mr. Cleese. Next minute, there's wine glasses all across the table, and he's going, I'll try this one. No, I always do this. Try this one. And they've opened every bottle of their best wine for him to... And then he goes, I think I'll do that. Thank you. I mean, it's amazing stuff. And then suddenly, obviously, the restaurant fills up in 15 minutes, and everyone's kind of looking. And it's just... But it's a chaotic way of living. You know, I imagine it, no, everywhere
I'm not,
he goes.
I'm not envious of that.
I mean, I know he's very recognizable and he's iconic amongst people of kind of our age and older.
Yes.
But I wouldn't expect him to command, especially in South Africa, to command the kind of attention where it's a real nuisance and crowds gather.
It's faulty towers,
no,
I think.
Spud, dude. I mean, like after the first movie, there was a whole generation of people who read the books and watched the movies.
Yeah. I love the movie.
No, we had some big chaotic nights of launches. Sure. I mean, one night with 2,000 people rocked up to the launch of Spud 3 in the square. Oh. I mean, I'd never seen them. We had them in huge bands playing. It was like a huge peak, you know what I mean? Yeah. It almost like it all came together, the movies, and so it was. But it's a different kind of thing, you know, that John Cleese thing. And one of the favorite things is he loves telling stories about other stars. So when he was working with Jamie Lee Curtis, and I mean, I don't know if you guys, but that's my best thing. You
Jamie
know?
Lee Curtis. You know,
so he's talking about Jamie Lee Curtis, then he's talking about Michael Palin.
She was a legendary belter. Sorry, for the listeners that can't see the look Sia just gave me.
She was a legendary belter.
Firstly, she's still quite lovely.
Yes.
And secondly, she was in that aerobic soft porn thing with John Travolta, which is still quite provocative. I'm surprised it got on the
still
screen.
Still on your bookshelf, yeah,
no,
is
I'm
it, Gordon?
Like, I'm surprised it got on the screen. It's really, really like provocative and for the time. But then she went away and made this massive hotness come back in that movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger, where she, like, the husband was a, was it Arnold Schwarzenegger? A True Lie. The husband is a secret agent and she doesn't know.
Yes.
Yeah, I think
and she
is.
Was crazy hot. Anyway, sorry, a bit of a tangent, but Jamie Lee Curtis is not to be scoffed at. C.S. Sangweni.
No.
C.S. Sangweni is just, he's totally obsessed with meeting Meghan Markle later today. It's all he
cares. Are you meeting
about
her today?
Oh! I know.
Excuse me. Composer.
So, John,
composer.
Are you hanging out in Joburg for a little while?
I'm going back today.
Okay.
I've got now deadlines, serious deadlines that I'm rolling on. But probably this time, September next year, I launch my new book, and then I'll be back up here for a good period.
We must talk to you when you
That'll
do.
That'll be great. Thank you.
I'm very keen to read it.
Yeah, please. Thank you.
Listen. People don't read as much as they used to. They don't have time for it. You do audiobooks?
I did. I read Spud 1 and I made an audio of that. And I think it's a very good idea. I'm going to talk to my publishers about this. You know, they've already prepped me for this. They've said, John, the publishing world of 2005, 2010 is a different world now. Mm. Like they
Who
have
are
such
your publishers?
Penguin, okay. They have such low expectations because of what can happen. You know,
I read something horrible the other day that they say that the total book buying market in South Africa is maybe 1 or 2 million people max.
Yeah, yeah,
that's all it is.
Yeah,
So in other words, that's for you to have sold 600,000-700,000 copies of your book means you almost got half the market. Okay.
Well, you know what I think? I got into a market
of people who read.
I think I got into a market of people who don't read. And that's why I think it's going to be a tough act to follow. People who don't read, but they read Spud, you know, because they were, you know, they were at boarding school or whatever the thing is.
But people can all listen. That's why I'm saying, like,
I agree with
audiobooks
you.
Are a good idea.
I agree. I think it's a great idea.
Especially if you've got a good voice as the author, because it's a weird thing. Like, sometimes authors that read their own books, I find the 10,000 Hours guy, Malcolm Gladwell.
Yes.
He reads his own books and he really shouldn't, because he ruins them with his horrible voice. But then sometimes, like,
Stephen Fry's mythos.
Yeah, and even Stephen King.
Stephen,
The Dark Tower is narrated by these wonderful narrators, but then there's this additional extra book that came later and he reads it, and you find out that he pronounces the names of his characters differently than the reader of his book.
Isn't that interesting?
Just for an example, like, everyone believes that the main character in The Dark Tower, Roland Deschain, is Roland Deschain, and it's Roland Deschain. And hearing Stephen King read his own story, he doesn't have that wonderful orating voice.
Yes.
You know, he's not missing a career as a voice artist, but he reads it in a certain way that's very authentic. So I always wonder, like, should authors read their own books or get voice artists? But the two of you both have lovely voices.
Well, Gareth has I think I should get Gareth to read my book.
You've got a wonderful voice. So you both should audiobook your books yourselves, in my opinion.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
Do the audio one, John.
I think you're right. And you know, with the rise and rise of podcasts and things like that now, I think that's becoming a normal way of getting your entertainment. You know?
And quadrupled the amount of book intake for me in the last 5 or 6 years.
That's it.
To be fair, also, people have time to listen. They don't always have time to read. Reading takes your entire attention, right? You can't do something else while you're reading. But you can drive to work while you're listening, and you can do some, you know, exercise or whatever it is that you do. So I think it's a great way for you know, reach a market you may already have had with Spud, but that might want more.
I think it's a brilliant idea. I'm going to seriously take that up with my publishers. I do.
Well, listen, you're such a success, and I mean, it's really just tremendous to see how well you've done. And I hope that these other books are going to be as wildly successful, and that you have lots of fun with the musical and all the other stuff too.
Thank you, Gareth.
It's amazing. You're keeping busy, man. You're hardly a slouch.
No, I'm not. And I know when you disappear, people think you're a slacker, but yeah.
No. With funny writers, you guys can get away with it a lot more than most.
You can.
Because people go, well, he's busy.
Because it's vague. Yeah. Like, all these projects are vague. You know, they don't know whether, you know, exactly.
They don't know what you're doing.
Exactly. It's privacy. It's standard.
Exactly. Thanks so much, man.
Thanks, Gareth.
Great to see you. John Funderate, everybody. And make sure that you go and watch the musical when that's on. But the theatre at Monte Cassino is busy putting on the performance of The Bushwhacker, and you can go and see that.
Yes, go see it, yeah.
3 to 20 October 2019, Benny Bushwhacker. And performances are Wednesdays to Fridays, 20-100 hours, Saturdays at 4 o'clock, and then 8 o'clock in the evening as well. Sundays at 3. Ticket prices, this is very reasonable, Gord. 130 to 180 rand.
Dude, theatre's a good time. And people should go more often. It really is
a good
time.
If and there's no age restriction.
There's no age restriction. It's a very impressive thing to take someone to on a date.
Yeah.
Like, ladies are like, ooh, theatre, you're exotic and interesting and don't just mostly watch Netflix in your underwear. Exactly. I'll date you.
Do that.
Later, disappointment.
And Joburgs need to get into the bush. You know, it's like the quickest way to get into the bush. Kruger's, what, 5 hours away, 3 hours away.
Well, congratulations.
Theatre is a very quick way to get into the bush.
Go and watch this show and then wait patiently for the musical of Spud, which comes out soon, and your next book, can't wait for that.
Thanks, Gareth.
Awesome. We'll see you on we'll see you tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock. Gordo, thanks so much.
What a jewel. Love you guys.
Good.
Cheers, Gordo. Cheers.
Awesome. Yep. Thanks. CliffCentral.com.